Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Harlan Levy, and today I'll be reading from the March 25th issue of the New Yorker magazine. The article is titled, Bid for the Stars, The Booming Market and the Stuff of Celebrity, by Rachel Monroe. The sidewalks of Lower Broadway in downtown Nashville are filled with people moving among neon-lit venues owned by celebrity musicians. Kid Rock's Big Ass Honky Tonk and Rock and Roll Steakhouse, Jason Aldean's Kitchen and Rooftop Bar, Miranda Lambert's Casa Rosa, the Hard Rock Cafe, which opened in 1994, when the neighborhood could still be reasonably called eclectic, sits at the far edge of the strip, overlooking the Cumberland River. One evening last November, Julian's Auctions took over a private room at the restaurant for a three-day sale in honor of the company's 20th anniversary. There was a spotlighted stage full of objects that musicians had worn or touched or played. A scratched amber ring that Janis Joplin wore on stage at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. Prince's gold snakeskin print suit, small enough to fit on an adolescent-sized mannequin. Ripped jeans that had belonged to Kurt Cobain. In the past year, the fine art market has cooled, owing to uncertainty about the economy. But prices for celebrity-adjacent objects keep going up. A few weeks before the Julian's event, Sotheby's had auctioned off Freddie Mercury's estate, drawing the most bidders the house had seen in two decades. There was zero rationality to the valuations. Chase McHugh, the director of memorabilia at Hard Rock International, told me. His mustache comb went for almost $200,000. The sale brought in more than $15 million, nearly quadruple the high estimate. When a blue-chip auction house such as Sotheby's or Christie's handles a celebrity estate, it's often because the estate includes valuable collections of contemporary art, like David Bowie's, or jewelry, like Wallace Simpson's. From its start in 2003, Julian's, which is based in Los Angeles, has focused on pop culture ephemera. In 2014, the company's co-founder, Darren Julian, appeared on a short-lived A&E show, Celebrity Home Raiders, visiting the homes of third-tier stars, Debbie Gibson, David Cassidy, and appraising their possessions. On the program, Julian, then in his mid-40s, looked fresh-faced and nervous, like a JV football coach in his first huddle. When I met him in Nashville, he wore a designer shirt and spoke with relaxed confidence. Julian's holds the record for selling the most expensive glove, Michael Jackson's, and the most expensive gown, Marilyn Monroe's, at auction. 13 guitars have sold publicly for more than $1 million. Julian sold 5 of them. This is the only specialty auction house in the world that does entertainment at this level and with such a wide breadth and depth. I mean, anyone from Mary Pickford to Amy Winehouse, Lila Dunbar, a former director of collectibles at Sotheby's, told me. They did the Ringo Starr sale. You don't get much better than a Beatle. And yet Julian has a remarkably unfraught relationship to objects. He doesn't own much memorabilia himself, and the particular excesses of the collector's mindset, the pride of the completist, the devouring appetite of the superfan, seem at odds with his cheerful, pragmatic demeanor. Hours before the Nashville sale began, I found Julian bent over his laptop. He apologized for being distracted. People have this vision of us as this massive company, he said. But he handles many administrative tasks himself. Bidders for the auction's highest-profile lots had to register in advance, and Julian was trying to ascertain whether the prospective clients actually had enough money to pay for them. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes you have to poke around on LinkedIn, he said. As the room started to fill, I talked with Chad Cobain, an affable man in a flax-colored cardigan and checkered Vans. Chad had signed a custom-made, left-handed, sky-blue Fender Mustang, the last guitar played by Kurt Cobain, his brother. Kurt died by suicide in 1994, when Chad was 15. After the memorial service, Courtney Love, Kurt's widow, presented Chad with a guitar. Black masking tape covered the logo on the strap, Kurt's gesture of anti-corporate protest. Chad, who was right-handed, could never play the guitar very well. By the early 2000s, he had stashed it in the closet of the one-bedroom apartment that he shared with his wife in Seattle. The sentiment had worn off. The guitar mostly made him nervous. "I couldn't afford to insure it. I was just worried about it all the time," he said. Chad reached out to Sotheby's, where Julian was working as a contractor. At the time, Julian's appraisal, $30,000, struck Chad as too low. He'd held on to the guitar, eventually lending it to the Museum of Pop Culture in Seattle, which kept it on display alongside Grandmaster Flash's turntables and Jimi Hendrix's silk kimono for 18 years. In 2015, the cardigan that Kurt wore during Nirvana's appearance on MTV Unplugged sold for $137,000. 4 years later, it went for more than twice that. Both sales were handled by Julian's. Two of Kurt's guitars, a 1959 Martin D18E from the Unplugged show, and a 1969 Fender Mustang from the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, also auctioned by Julian's, became the most and second most expensive guitars to be sold publicly, going for $6 million and $4 million, respectively. Material owned by celebrities who died young, like Cobain, often fetches a premium. An early death imbues objects with an added allure, and also means that supplies are limited. Julian told me that Cobain memorabilia is particularly collectible, because Nirvana's music appeals both to baby boomers and to wealthy millennials, increasing the likelihood of a bidding war. In September 2023, Chad left Julian a voicemail. "I was thinking, maybe in 5 years I'd sell it," he told me. Julian returned the call within minutes. A few weeks later, Chad agreed to consign the Fender. In Nashville, he seemed a little stunned. "It feels like this all happened 2 weeks ago," he told me. Julian's had given the guitar a low estimate of $1 million. Chad told me that he had asked what kinds of people were likely to bid, and was told basically hedge fund managers. I was like, "Okay, gross," he said, shrugging, "but it makes sense." The Fender was on stage, surrounded by a collection of Kurt ephemera, notebook pages covered in doodles and tortured ramblings, an empty pack of American Spirit cigarettes, an Argyle sweater. These objects had come to Julian's from a man who had been Kurt's roommate in rehab. In early April 1994, Kurt climbed over a wall to escape the facility, leaving his possessions behind. A week later, he was dead. Whereas certain kinds of memorabilia, baseball cards and comic books among them, are more valuable in pristine condition, the opposite is often true of celebrity-owned objects, whose buyers prefer a bodily trace of the former owner. The Unplugged cardigan, which was until recently the most expensive sweater ever sold at auction, had a small amount of something brown and crusty, possibly dried vomit, in a pocket. Chad looked up at his brother's jeans on the stage. The auction house's high estimate was $20,000. They end up selling for more than $400,000. Courtney gave me a bunch of his clothes, too. I just wore them, and then I probably gave them to Goodwill, Chad said. Looking at this, I'm like, oh, man, but I wasn't thinking about the hedge fund managers when I was 16. 2 years ago, Kim Kardashian, an occasional bidder at Julian's auctions, she once bought a velvet jacket owned by Michael Jackson as a gift for her 6-year-old daughter, reached out to Julian with an idea. For the red carpet of the Met Gala, Kardashian wanted to borrow the backless columnar dress that Marilyn Monroe wore when she serenaded John F. Kennedy at his 45th birthday party. In 2016, Julian's had sold the dress for nearly $5 million. Julian approached the owner, the L.A. Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, on Kardashian's behalf. The negotiations were delicate. The dress was fragile. Monroe had been sewn into it hours before she sang to Kennedy. Ripley suggested that Kardashian wear a replica. "Kim doesn't do replicas," Julian told them. The museum ultimately agreed to lend the original. Julian said that he caught a lot of grief from the fashion historians for facilitating the loan. Celebrity is an elusive and unstable form of currency. Reputations can change quickly. Barbara Walters' estate sale at Bonham's netted millions less than the auction house had estimated. At Kirstie Alley's recent estate auction, many objects didn't meet their reserve prices. A lot of the objects that Julian sells are mass-produced with little intrinsic value. "We're more of a marketing company than anything," Julian told me. By this reasoning, procuring the dress for Kardashian was worth it. It generated headlines, plus it shored up Monroe's value for potential future bidders. In 100 years, the dress isn't going to be. It's a mesh. It's going to be disintegrated, Julian said. But, he added, of the dress's appearance at the gala, it was fun, and it introduced Marilyn to a whole new generation. Julian grew up in Indiana, where his father operated several granaries. His family expected that he would work in agriculture, but his attention was elsewhere. "Indiana is an auction state," he told me. "Farmers bid on livestock and echoing barns. If a couple can't agree on a divorce settlement, a judge might order an auction of their marital property, with the proceeds split down the middle." Julian was enthralled by the auctioneer's incantatory patter and their casual command of the room. He was an indifferent student, but an enthusiastic entrepreneur, hawking his father's cast-offs at flea markets on the weekend. I'd be this 7 or 8-year-old kid with a weed whacker telling people, "Let me tell you why you have to buy this," he said. At 16, he moved to an apartment by himself in Auburn, in the heart of auction country, to attend a better high school. The town was home to the Ruppert Auction School, which taught students how to perform the auction chant, the rhythmic, repetitive solicitation of bids that's sometimes called the cattle rattle. Auburn was the headquarters of Cruise International, whose vintage car auctions became a worldwide phenomenon in the 80s. Its annual Labor Day auction featured rotating stages, celebrity attendees, and a parade of historic vehicles. It was, at one point, the third most attended event in Indiana. Mitchell Cruz, the company's former owner and CEO, worked his first auction in Tulsa in 1981, when he was a sophomore in high school. "It was the peak of the oil boom, and I'm telling you, it was incredible," he told me. "Buyers were hungry for rarities. It was like a who's who of the rich and famous. $100,000 watches, everyone wanting to one-up the other guy." 4 years later, when Cruz was 20, he sold the first car to go for $1 million in cash. 1 year, when the featured Labor Day lot was the Batmobile, Cruz received a call from Ross Perot. He said, "I'm looking at your car catalog, and I'm looking at this Batmobile. Can fire come out of that?" Cruz told me. And I said, "Yes, it can shoot flames, sir." Julian started working for Cruz. He knew that he didn't have the confidence to be an auctioneer, so he dreamed of being a ringman, the person who keeps an eye on bidders and relays information to the auctioneer with hand signals. After he graduated from high school, Julian expanded a business selling pneumatic tennis ball serving machines, which he'd started as a teenager with a friend's father. The work got him out of the Midwest. Once he went to the U.S. Open with Andre Agassi, whose father had advised on the machine's design, but the upside was limited. "The tennis ball machine business wasn't going to take me anywhere," he said. In the mid-90s, Julian returned to Indiana to run Cruz's Labor Day auction. A few years later, he was on Johnny Cash's tour bus, celebrating a successful auction of the singer's classic cars, when Cash asked him what he planned to do with the rest of his life. Julian confessed that he loved auctions, but hated cars. It was the stuff that appealed to him. In August 1926, Rudolph Valentino died at the age of 31 from complications of a ruptured ulcer. 3 months later, his business manager, George Ullman, put Valentino's possessions up for public sale. Not only his speedboat, his onyx pocket watch, and his black velvet riding habit, but also his spats and silk underwear and 146 pairs of his socks. The auction drew oil millionaires, flapperish girls, and tourist wives of Middle Western farmers, according to newspaper accounts. Almost everything the actor owned, even his pet dogs and horses, was for sale. But Ullman held a few things back: collar buttons, cufflinks, certain pairs of shoes. "The items almost talked to me," Ullman told a friend. "I couldn't stand to watch them go to strangers." Celebrity auctions typically used to be a result of the three D's, death, divorce, or debt. Laura Woolley, a longtime pop culture appraiser and a managing director at Jillian's, told me. The most iconic sales involved celebrities who were elegant, wealthy, and no longer living. When Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis' estate was auctioned off in 1996, Sotheby's sold more than 100,000 copies of a catalog. In 1987, Wallace Simpson's jewelry collection brought in $55 million from bidders including Elizabeth Taylor and Joan Collins. According to George Newman, a professor of organizational psychology and marketing at the University of Toronto, who has studied celebrity auctions, the psychological principle driving buyers is the idea of contagion, sometimes summarized as once in contact, always in contact. On some level, we are convinced that a person's essence passes into the objects that he handles. It's nothing material. It's more like a magical belief that these objects have acquired something, Newman told me. And that belief seems to have a real effect on the amount of money people are willing to pay. A researcher who interviewed members of the Central Midwest Barry Manilow fan club in the 90s found that their most valued items were things in the collection that actually touched Barry. In an experiment, when subjects were told that a celebrity-owned sweater had been sterilized, their willingness to pay for it declined significantly. The opposite was true when it came to infamous people. Subjects tended to say that they wouldn't wear a sweater owned by Hitler. Sterilizing the hypothetical sweater, though, made them regard it more favorably. Jillian eventually left Cruise and moved to California, where he made connections with the collectibles department at Sotheby's. He was extremely persistent and very earnest, Dunbar of Sotheby's said. In 2003, Jillian established his own auction house. Martin Nolan, a tall, droll Irishman with a background in finance, later joined him as the company's chief financial officer and eventually its co-owner. In 2006, Cher enlisted Jillian's, which had a half dozen employees, to run a sale. She was redecorating her home, going from a neo-Gothic look to Zen Buddhist, Nolan recalled, and had lots of candelabras and heavy oak lecterns to offload. She also understood that an auction house could promote a living celebrity. She said she'd rather put needles in her eyes than have a bad catalog, Nolan said. Specialists from Sotheby's, which co-sponsored the sale, appraised the obviously high-value items. Diamond jewelry, Bob Mackie gowns, while Jillian kept an eye out for objects with more personal qualities, such as her dictionary and her high school biology workbook. He fished a table lamp made from a taxidermied armadillo out of the dumpster after Cher told him it had been a gift from Gene Simmons, whom he had dated. On the day of the auction, Cher was so nervous that she'd be judged for selling her stuff, or worse, that no one would want to buy it, that she arranged to be out of the country. But the lots sold even faster than Jillian had expected. The armadillo lamp went for upward of $4,000, more than 10 times the estimate. These days, any sense that it's unseemly for living stars to auction off their things has evaporated. Ringo, he was the last person who was really concerned about that. Now, nobody cares, Jillian said. All these people have storage units, and Live Nation doesn't take a cut of memorabilia sales. As streaming has reduced the revenue that comes from making albums, such sales have proved appealing to musicians. When I visited the Jillian's Auctions headquarters in a warehouse building on the industrial fringes of Los Angeles, I spied a stack of glossy catalogs featuring various celebrity names, Dolly Parton and Bob Dylan among them. These were mock-ups that Jillian's uses to entice potential clients. The auction catalog has a kind of ghost-written autobiography, a life told through objects. Wringing money out of a star's image and objects can be emotionally and ethically precarious. In 2008, Jillian's was hired to clear out Neverland Ranch, Michael Jackson's fantastical estate near Santa Barbara, and prepare its contents for auction. The job had an air of desperation to it. Jackson was in dire financial straits. The property, 2,700 acres, had sat empty for some time, and the on-site amusement park had an eerie weathered atmosphere. Julian's hired a crew of 30 to sort through everything. There's the house, the theater, the zoo, the teepee village, the big railroad station, the small railroad station, Nolan said. We were working day and night. Julian thought that the auction would net at least $15 million, so the company took out loans to finance the job. Julian's receives typically about a 35% commission. Everything was dependent on this, Julian said. How we agreed to take it on, I have no idea. We were naive. In April 2009, a month before the auction, Jackson's production company, MJJ Productions, sued to stop it, claiming that Julian's was attempting to sell items that were priceless and irreplaceable, and which Jackson had intended to keep. We have been accommodating any request made by Michael Jackson for the past 8 months, Julian told CNN. If it is true, and he is stating that there are items he does not want sold, why would he have ever given up the items in the first place? We are an auction house, and that is all that we do. We are not a mover or storage facility. As the case made its way through the courts, Julian's installed an elaborate auction preview in a former department store in Beverly Hills. Ultimately, Julian's and MJJ Productions agreed to a settlement, and the possessions were returned to Jackson. 2 months later, he died. By the time the auctioneer, wearing a bow tie and thick-rimmed glasses, introduced the first lot at the Hard Rock Cafe, the room was fizzy with anticipation. The big item that night was Eric Clapton's 1964 electric Gibson, believed to have been a gift from George Harrison. You feel like you're going back 50 years by just picking it up, one middle-aged man told me reverently. Most bidding at Julian's auctions happens remotely, either online or over the phone, but some prospective buyers still like to show up in person. A group of chatty, buoyant people sat at a table, cluttered with drinks. Across from them, a man in a dark suit sat alone, a sheaf of papers in front of him, his shoulders braced in the tense posture of someone who has been authorized to spend $1 million of his boss's money. This was Larry Hall, who was bidding on Clapton's guitar on behalf of Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts and a major collector of pop culture objects. Irsay's collection, which he hopes to turn into a museum one day, includes the original scroll manuscript of On the Road, Muhammad Ali's boxing shoes, John F. Kennedy's rocking chair, and a wanted poster for John Wilkes Booth. Various people in the memorabilia world had pitched me on the idea of celebrity-owned objects as undervalued assets. Clients are looking at these pieces like they would a piece of art, Dunbar, who left Sotheby's to run her own business, appraising pop culture memorabilia, said. You could have a Warhol on your wall, or you could have Michael Jordan's Game 1, 1998 NBA Finals jersey. Some of Julian's clients have bought high-profile pieces and flipped them a few years later for a significant profit. Earlier that week, Julian had spoken with a bidder interested in the Clapton guitar. I said, look, if you got this for $2 million, it would be a steal, he told me. You could probably resell it in a few years. As we waited for the guitar to come up for sale, I asked one attendee, a vice president at Credit Suisse, who didn't want to be named, if he thought of his purchases as investments. He gave me a pitying look. That's what you tell your wife, he said. No, this is purely a passion business. The auctioneer, straight-faced, declared the Gibson, with its custom psychedelic finish, to be the greatest guitar in the history of guitars. Within seconds, Hall had bid $1 million. Julia conferred on the phone with another prospective buyer, then gave a decisive negative shake of his head. The auctioneer swooped his hands like an orchestra conductor, trying to coax more money from the room. Even the boozy table grew hushed. Clapton became the man he is, the guitarist he is, on this guitar, and you can have that for $1.25 million, the auctioneer said. No one moved. It seemed as though we might be cheated of the drama of a bidding war. The auctioneer banged his gavel and declared the lot sold, and Hall's face spasmed with joy. We got it, he said to no one in particular. We got it. Later, I watched him grasp the hand of a well-wisher. I feel like I just stole a guitar, he said. Chad Cobain left the auction early. Kurt's guitar was slotted to come up for sale the next day. "I'll probably just watch from the hotel room," he told me. "It's going to be emotional." The Mustang ended up selling for $1.5 million to a Japanese businessman who plans to put it on display in a music-themed cafe. Although the market for seven-figure guitars is limited, auction houses see memorabilia and collectibles more broadly as an area of great growth potential, Natasha Dagan, the chair of the Art Market Studies Department at FIT, told me. It appreciated dramatically during COVID, Dunbar said. People were at home, they were nostalgic, they had money, the auctions were accessible, and it was sort of a circle. The more people bid the prices up, the more people got interested. Celebrity auction houses like Julian's have been taking cues from the world of sports. Fanatics, the sports collectibles juggernaut, has been particularly ingenious at capitalizing on the fandom economy. The company sells collectibles featuring small slices of balls, bases, pucks, and nets from NHL and MLB games. For $50, you can buy a Yankees-branded pen that comes with a sprinkling of authentic game-used dirt. Nolan spoke about the machinery of sports memorabilia sales with some envy. "Players are sometimes wearing a different jersey each quarter," he said. "It's sent off and available in the market tomorrow." Julian's has begun encouraging the musicians it works with to think of their clothing as a commodity. "We encourage, we educate them. When you get done with a concert, put the jeans, the shirt, the shoes in a bag with a date and the city to put in the archives, because that could be $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, Julian said. It's like printing money for a lot of these celebrities. In Nashville, I chatted with Ricky Lyman, a genial tattooed man who worked at Julian since the Neverland Ranch days. He was idly looking through the auction lots online, scrolling past the guitars to the items with 3- and 4-figure estimates. Elvis's Phillips 66 charge card, Elvis membership card from the International Kempo Karate Association, Elvis's father's Bible. In Lyman's years at Julian's, he has bid and won a handful of items, including David Hasselhoff's leather-lined trench coat and a scepter that once belonged to Marlon Brando. There's a talisman for every taste. Joan Didion's collection of pebbles and seashells recently sold at auction for $7,000. Paul Newman's pocket knife, $8,000. Mary Desjardins, a professor of film and media studies at Dartmouth, compared such items to Saints relics. Something like Elvis's gas card, that has little value to someone who's a historian or a scholar of Elvis, she said. It really doesn't have anything to do with his talents or his history as a performer. It's just because Elvis touched it, because it belonged to him. It's a bit of a fetish object. And the way fetish objects work, they're sort of magical, in that the proximity to them, the touching of them, gives you some sort of power or sense of self that can't be acquired otherwise. Proximity to a celebrity's death can lend an object an additional ghoulish frisson. This seems to be particularly true when the celebrity died under tragic circumstances. In 2020, a seller was shopping around an album that John Lennon had autographed for Mark David Chapman, who later fatally shot him. Yoko said, "Please don't," Julian told me. He passed on the consignment. Another auction house sold the album for nearly $1 million. 2 years after Michael Jackson's fatal overdose, Julian's put the bed where he died up for sale. After Jackson's family objected, the house pulled the listing. On some occasions, the company has shown a more flexible sense of propriety. Julian's has sold William Shakespeare's kidney stone and Truman Capote's ashes. Truman Capote loved the element of shock, Julian said at the time. He loved publicity, and I'm sure he's looking down laughing and saying, "That's something I would have done." This spring, Julian's plans to auction off a burial crypt to a West Hollywood mausoleum. The crypt, situated in the Corridor of Memories, is a row above and 4 spaces to the left of Marilyn Monroe's, and even closer to Hugh Hefner's. Hefner bought the space next to Monroe, whom he had never met, in 2009. "I'm a believer in things symbolic," he told the Los Angeles Times. "Spending eternity next to Marilyn is too sweet to pass up." A man had offered to consign the burial space to Julian's a few years earlier. When Julian went to visit it, he was surprised to see that someone was already interred there. I told him, "I can't sell a crypt with somebody in it," Julian told me. He goes, "Oh, that's my mom. I'm thinking about moving her." The crypt, newly vacant, has an estimate of at least $200,000. In November, Laura Woolley, the Julian's managing director, met me at the company's main warehouse in L.A. Woolley started out in the Sotheby's collectibles department and did a stint at Julian's during its early days. Her job involved watching every episode of a Sonny and Cher show to determine the provenance of clothing for the Cher auction, before opening her own appraisal business specializing in pop culture memorabilia. She returned to Julian's last year when the company went on a hiring spree. It now has 36 employees. In 1999, Christie's held an auction of Marilyn Monroe's things. That was a watershed moment. People were paying like $37,000 for a Polaroid of her dog. Monroe had left her personal effects and the bulk of her intellectual property to her acting teacher, Lee Strasberg. After a decades-long probate process, they were eventually inherited by Strasberg's third wife, Anna, who licensed the actress's image liberally and enlisted Christie's to sell the possessions. Julian's has since sold further remnants from Monroe's life, including her prescription pill bottles, her tax returns, a letter to her psychiatrist, and a lock of her hair. Before the auction, Woolley was alone in the warehouse, cataloging some of Monroe's items. Intimate things, she said. Hairpins, undergarments. The bras were lumpy and misshapen because they were padded with sawdust. This is the reality of what we do. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I'm Harlan Levy, and I'm reading from the March 25th issue of the New Yorker magazine. So long, until next time.